is pretty packed. There are a couple of major episodes that appear in this Aliyah. And also, it's just interesting following our synergy. If you want to see common themes in Shishis that we've seen, there are still continuing links to previous Shishis, which I don't know what to make of that, but it's just worth noting. So here, the Aliyah begins kind of mid-sentence, in the middle of a Haftacha to Yaakov. And the Aliyah begins, Yes, Aretz, Asher Nasati, L'Avram, Uli Yitzchak, L'chad Nena, Uzaracha, Charecha, Eten, Yes, Aretz. So Yaakov is promised that the land will be given to him and to his descendants. And the Pasuk continues, V'yal mi'alav Elokim, B'mokom asher diber yito. So God then went from him in that place where he spoke to him. So this idea of that place where he spoke to him, so we're going to see in a few psukim, he's going to call it Beis El. So Rav Shaul Hirsch maintains over here that you see from the context, this is not the same Beis El from the beginning of the parsha, and suggests that wherever there is a man who's worthy of God's presence, so that gets called Beis El, and it's not necessarily the same place. However, if you look in the Oznayim B'Torah, he has a different assumption here. He assumes that it was the same place, but that Yaakov wasn't able to figure out exactly where the same place was for sure until he saw that Hashem spoke to him from there, so that showed him that it was indeed the same place. And to continue that theme, so we see also that Vayatzev Yaakov Matzev Makom Asher Diber Oto Matzev Es Oven. So Yaakov sets up a matzeva over there. That's the number of matzevas in the Salio. He sets up this matzeva in this place, Matzeves Oven, this rock, this matzeva of rock. And he goes on to say, again, Doznayim L'Torah, that that's also a remnant of the fact that this is the same rock from the beginning of the parasha. So not only did he find the same place, but he found the same rock. The Sarim comment at the beginning of the parsha that Rashi tells us that Vayikach me'avne hamakom, that he took from the multiple rocks and they all became one rock. And there are those who explain that when he says that Einzak Kiyam Beis Elokim, he recognizes that it's a house of God. He recognizes that's a shul. So some of the Sarim ask, so how did he know that it was a shul? Because, like Rashi says, that these 12 rocks were each fighting who should be the one that the tzaddik is going to sleep on. And then eventually they have to get merged into one rock. So when he saw people fighting over kibbutim, he realized he was in the shul. So he was able to find this rock as the reminder, and he came back to that same place. So, sorry? Yeah, I don't remember where I saw that. I saw it in the sefer. I saw it in the actual Hebrew sefer. I don't remember which one, though. So he made a libation on it. So whether, I think the first comments here, whether the Nesach was of water or of wine, so either way, it's meant to symbolize water is the source of all sustenance, wine is the source of joy. Either way, he's making the point that God is the source of sustenance, God is the source of joy, and that's the message of this Nisuch. And Vayikra Yaakov v'shem ha'makom asher diber ito, Sham Elohim Beis El. So again, whether it's the same Beis El or not, that's the point you mentioned a few moments ago. This Naim LaTorah also, again, continuing his theme here, quotes something that he heard from an elder Talmud Chacham, who was a Talmud of the Chassan Sofer, that he conveyed to him the idea that you have here three times the phrase Asher Diber Oto Elohim. So that's a remez to the three Batei Mikdash that will eventually be on this significant place. Okay, so Vayisubi Beisel, Vahi Od Kibras Arat Lavoat Rasa, Vatelet Rachel, Vatakash Blutita. So they journeyed from Beisel, and there was still space left to go. And along the way, so Rachel goes into labor, and it's difficult. Vahi Bahakshosa Blutita, Vatomer Lav Yeledes, Al Tirihi, Ki Gamzel Lach Ben. So that's the commentaries all ask, the Archaim and the Sparno. Everyone asks, it's a little bit of a strange kind of response. That here, as we'll eventually see, she's dying here in childbirth, and the nurse says to her, well, don't worry, this is a boy. it's not really going to be so much in the Chumash. So they all comment, and also the Nine Torah has a comment here also, and Torah Tamino, that it's not saying that it's worth dying as long as it's a boy. The point is that she had asked, she had davened for another son. And if she would die feeling like her tefillah was rejected, that would be a source of agnus nefesh for her. So at least she should know that her tefillah came true. And they also point out that the Gemara says in Nida that the pains of childbirth that are associated with having a female are greater than that which is associated with having a male. So when she realized that that was what she was going through, she thought maybe it meant that it was a girl. So the nurse said to her that it's a boy, and you should know that your tefillah was accepted. So then the next pasuk says, "Vahi b'tzei snafsha ki meisa." It's very tragic. She dies while giving birth. But just before that, "Vatikra shmo ben Oni v'aviv karolo v'nyamin." So she called him ben Oni, and Yaakov called him Binyamin. So the Medrash has a comment that ben Oni, the son of her affliction, is really an Aramaic usage, while Yaakov used a Hebrew name. And the Zayin Torah has a fascinating comment here. It says that at the moment of death, so people tend to be in a different psychological state of mind, and they have flashback memories. So she was going back to the language of her childhood, and she started talking in Aramaic, and that's why she said it like that. The Gemara Maseches Sota and Daf Lamed Zayin points out that here Binyamin is spelled Male with a Yod at the end, where in the rest of the Torah it's usually spelled Chaser. Gemara sounds like it's always spelled Chaser, not always, but it's generally spelled Chaser. And the Torah Tamima points out that that's because it's necessary here to explain the name, that the son of my right hand. So it has to be spelled with a yud for that to make sense. But the rest of the Torah, since the sound is the same, so it's not spelled that way. Hi.
Didn't something very similar happen with Yaakov and Laban, where they were the naming a place, and Laban chose the Aramaic name, and Yaakov chose the Hebrew translation?
Saying go back to saying so Taka, that's Laban being the father of Rachel, so she's going back to her youth, and she's talking Aramaic. He doesn't mention Laban specifically, but it's an interesting kind of parallel. So in any event, so Vatamas Rachel, Vatikaver b'derech avrasa, he beis lafem. So Rachel passes away, and she is buried there along the path. So the Ramban has a comment here, which is well known, that she had to die before entering Eretz Yisrael, because he addresses the question that many others address also, and the question of, if we assume that the Avos kept Kol Torah Kula, so how could Yaakov be married to two sisters? And the Ramban works off the premise that they kept the Torah only when in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, as they were going back to Eretz Yisrael, so he had to only have one wife, only one wife among the sisters, and therefore Rachel couldn't survive. Rav Soloveitchik, in his drashas, expanded on this, and he said the nature of the bris between Avram and his sons and the Kadosh Baruch Hu is that Eretz Yisrael is intertwined with their spirituality. So the bris is connected inseparably from Eretz Yisrael. But after Matan Torah, we give them the Torah itself, so that creates a bris that exists also outside of Eretz Yisrael, and that's a fundamental distinction, and that's how we understood this idea of the Ramban, that the Avos kept the Torah specifically then. Hi.
How do we understand on a theological level that they didn't have to keep the Torah outside of Israel? Yaakov lived his life without keeping the Torah for a large portion.
I mean, how do we understand the fact that they weren't obligated to?
Yeah.
Well, they weren't obligated at all, which is a point I think we discussed last week, right? Did it come up in...
If they weren't obligated, that means they didn't... If the Ramban say you didn't keep the Torah outside of Eretz Yisrael, how do we understand that that one of the Avot didn't keep the Torah for some of his life?
Well, he wasn't obligated to, so that doesn't necessarily have to trouble us. know, the question, we have this idea, I think it came up last week or the week before, where we were talking about the whole scope of the almost keeping the Torah, which is always challenging. There's a lot of discussion about it and what exactly it represents and to what degree, and the maximalist interpretations and minimalist interpretations. But there are always these kashas, such as Yaakov marrying two sisters and a few other questions. So part of the necessary premise here is that they weren't obligated to keep the mitzvos at all. You know, they kept the mitzvos as a voluntary recognition of the spiritual accomplishments that are involved. So what this Ramban is suggesting, and which Soloveitchik is fleshing out, is that that was a part of the Eretz Yisrael spirituality, and then Chutz La'aretz, they didn't necessarily have that, although presumably Yaakov kept it. If you want to kind of combine ideas here, you could say that he really kept it almost totally, probably outside Eretz Yisrael also, and it's just that B'Shas Hadchak, so to speak, where he had this need to marry two sisters, so then, okay, he was more makel, but you didn't see it as really necessary except in Eretz Yisrael. I think we discussed, we talked about that in the context of Yosef. Maybe we'll see if we can talk about that Hanukkah time coming up soon, has a little more relevance to that. But that's a topic which comes up again and again. There is a striking statement in the Medrash that the Medrash suggests that there's a shtickel and onesh here for Rachel because she spoke up in front of her older sister, in front of Leah, back in Parak Lamed Aleph, which is hard to understand how that should justify such a punishment. Wow, that merits such a consequence. But from a technical halachic perspective, so there is a discussion whether or not one is obligated and covered for one's older sister. You know, the Gemara says there's an obligation of covered for an older brother. So the question is, does that only apply to older brothers, or does that apply to older sisters as well? So the Shvus Yaakov has a tshuva about this, and he says, don't bring a raya from here. Don't think that this is significant, because this reflects the idea, as Mishnah Pirkei Avos, that one shouldn't speak in front of a gadol mimenu in general, whether it's somebody you're chayiv and covered to or not. It's a general idea. But in any event, many assume, probably the prevalent assumption of Lachal Maisa, that one is obligated and covered to older sisters and to all older siblings. And the question generally is that this Gemara in Subas that says is a chi of covered to the older brother, so does that mean only the oldest brother, Din Bechor? That seems to be the understanding of the Rambam. Or do we say it's not about Bechor, but it's about, like the Ramban understands, that it's about whoever is older, because the assumption is there's a detail in Kibbutz Av Ein that presumably the parents would want that there should be a hierarchy in the family, that the younger siblings should respect the older siblings. And if that's the case, it's not a din in Bechor, it's not a din in the boys. So whoever is older, even if they're not the oldest, and even if they are not the oldest brother, the din should apply. So I think many of some sofer as a tshuva, many assume Rahalach like that, that it applies to everyone, that applies to all older siblings, but this may or may not be a raya. So, in any event, so here we find, now that she has passed away, so there's another matzeva. So, we had said Yaakov matzeva al kvurasa, he matzevas kvuras Rachel ad hayom, taka ad hayom mamash, you know, look, kever Rachel is visited. This is the matzeva that he placed for her. So there's a little bit of a discussion. This matzeva, as Naim Torah points out, this is the first tombstone that we actually find in Jewish history. And he has three explanations for it. It says, first of all, the usage of the name Ben Oni, where she's talking about her suffering. So that conveys that she was looking for a memorial. She was looking for something that would give this some permanence. So therefore, the matzeva was fitting for that. Also, because her burial path was on the derech, was on the path, was on the road, it was very conceivable that people would not know where it is, would forget. And also, until then, the practice was, as we see with the other avos, and Emos was to bury in caves. So here, burial outside of a cave, that required a different kind of marker, and all of that is conveyed with this. There's a little bit of discussion with Torah Tamim and others for him, that there is a statement in the Gemara that Ein Ostim Nefashos L'Tzadikim Divreim Heim Heim Zichronim, that we don't have to make memorials for Tzadikim because their words and their lives are their lasting legacy. So here we find that they do make a matzeva. So they discuss, it's probably not an actual policy, because they do have tombstones since then for Tzadikim. But also there's a suggestion that Torah Tamima has that means that the tzaddik doesn't need it. The tzaddik doesn't need that this tombstone should be there or the memorial should be there for their own sake, because they will be remembered with or without that. But for us, sometimes we need a tombstone, and therefore that comes to serve that purpose. And he has a discussion of nafkaminas. What if the person himself insists on no such memorial? So is it for his sake, or is it for the sake of everyone else? That's a part of the discussion which surrounds this pasuk. Okay, so then the next pasuk tells us that Yaakov travels, Vayisa Yisrael, Vayet Ahalo, Mehalal Migdal Eder. So he went and he spread his tent beyond Migdal Eder. Vayhi Bishkon Yisrael, Vaaretz Ahi, Vayelech Ruvein, Vayishkav Ez Bilha, Pilegesh Aviv, Vayishma Yisrael, Vayuvene Yaakov Shnemasar. So here you have a very short version of the story, a very short telling, the whole Maisa of Reuven. And the Maisa of Reuven clearly evokes a lot of commentary, and it also sometimes focuses on the abrupt end of the pasuk, which also has a break in the middle of the pasuk, which goes on to say, V'yu b'nei Yaakov Shnemasar, that first of all, that itself is somewhat dramatic, the break in the middle of the pasuk, but also to add that the sons of Yaakov were 12, what does that tell us? What is that necessary for? So there is, as you'd expect, much commentary on this, what exactly it is that Reuven did here. So it sounds like from the pasuk that Reuven had a relationship here with Bilha, but the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos and Daftan Hay Lebeis from Shmuel Bar Nachmeini, we have that Gemara also about David HaMelech and Bathsheba. So here, similar to that, he says about Reuven, you know, anyone who says that Reuven sinned is making a mistake. Some of the Sfarim point out, it doesn't say that he's a sinner to say he sinned. It's not something to be criticized that someone thinks Reuven sinned, because the Torah allows us to think that. The Torah puts it in such a phrasing that certainly reflects negatively. But the language of the Gemara is it's a mistake to make the point that Reuven didn't actually do what it literally sounds like, but rather he messed up the bed or he removed the bed. He did something to interfere, which was so shocking, so it's considered to be as if he actually had a physical relationship with her. The Rashi here comments that this happened before he made it back to Hebron to be with, before Yaakov made it back to Hebron to be with Yitzchak, and Osnayim Torah comments that this whole Maisa happening then is a Mida Keneged Mida, that here Yaakov delays in getting back to take care of his father. That's a lack of Kiburav. So as a consequence, so he also suffers a lack of Kiburav, that he gets demeaned and disgraced through this shocking episode, which may not have been exactly what it sounds like, but was still pretty bad. Rav Schwab, in his commentary, Rav Schwab and his Sefer, suggests that maybe you could say that it was actually literal, just not euphemistic. So what does the word mean by Yishkav? So really, literally means to lie down. So maybe it means he came in fully dressed into the tent and he lay down in the bed, and he did that in order to create the impression that a man had been there, and thus to distance Yaakov from her. So perhaps you could say that it was literal, but still wasn't exactly the Avera that the Torah is perhaps otherwise implying. Rav Rivlin, the Mashkiach of Karen B'Yavna, has a whole essay about this in his Sefer on Bereishis, And he goes through a little bit of the background of this episode. And he has a different interpretation. He suggests that here Yaakov had intention to be with Bilhah in order to have another son, in order to have a 13th Shevet. And Reuven felt that that was inappropriate, at least shouldn't be with Bilhah, should be with his mother. So therefore he interfered. How did he interfere? So he suggests that Yaakov was with Bilhah in the tent, and Reuven came in. So if Reuven is in the house, is in the room, Ke'ilu, so then Yaakov couldn't be with Bilhah in that way. So therefore he interfered, and that of course is quite shocking and intrusive. But the result being that there was no 13th son born, so that's why the Torah emphasizes that he had 12 sons, and only 12 sons. But this line, 12 sons, is also quoted by the Gemara as proof that Reuven did not sin, because the 12 sons were all still considered to be equal, or all still considered to be inheritors. Nobody got disinherited, so therefore that's the way that they understand that this is not the Avera that it otherwise sounds like. It's interesting that he calls Bilhah Pilegesh here, and again, here is some Shishi symmetry, that the whole concept of Pilegesh we discussed a few weeks ago, I think, in Chayisar and Shishi. So here, Pilegesh comes up now in terms of Bilhah, so why is she called a Pilegesh? She's not really a Shifcha who became a wife. So some of the Svarim suggest that Reuven thought that she was never fully emancipated and wasn't a full wife, and thought therefore she must be a Pilegesh, and therefore thought that her sons didn't have the Yichus connection to Yaakov because it wasn't a full marriage. So therefore the Torah emphasizes that Pilegesh, that's what he thought. But no, even Yaakov Shemasar, that all the 12 sons were Mesiaches to Yaakov, and that Reuven's assumption there was wrong. It's also very abrupt, this whole phrasing, Vayishma Yisrael, Vayuvne Yaakov. So it switches from Yisrael to Yaakov in very short order. And Soloveitchik commented about that, that the name Yisrael is a name of Gedula, and the name of Yaakov is a more submissive name. And this reflects the shift in how he was demeaned and degraded by the actions of Reuven. So in the middle of the pasuk, his name switches from Yisrael back to Yaakov. Okay, so let's just go through the next few psukim, get to the next topic. B'nei Leah, B'chor Yaakov Reuven, B'shem Revelein, B'yud, B'yisachar Zvulun, B'nei Rachel, Yosef Yamin, B'nei Vila, Shivchas Rachel, Dan V'naftali, B'nei Zilpa, Shivchas Leah, Gad V'asher, Eila, B'nei Yaakov, Asher, Yula, Lo, B'fad Nanaram. So those are the names of all the sons. B'yavo Yaakov, El Yitzchak Aviv, Mamre, Kiryas Ha'arba, Hi Chevron, Asher Gar Shav, Avram v'Yitzchak. So Yaakov comes to Yitzchak in all these places, all the same place, and this is where Avram and Yitzchak had lived. Svarim suggests that Yitzchak was making sure to be in that area because he knew that he was going to be buried there. He was going to be buried in Maris Machpelah, and he knew that he was nearing that time. So therefore, some put it, he wanted to have his kever in eyesight, so that it should be a musar, because the Gemara says, Yasker Yom HaMisa, if you want to make sure that you're going to stay on the straight and narrow, or you'll fight the Yitzhara, and also so that they shouldn't have to be moved too much after he passes away, so he made sure to be in proximity. So the pasuk continues, Vayu Yima Yitzchak Ma'as Shana U'shmorim Shana, so he lived to be 180 years, Vayigva Yitzchak Vayamas Ve'asaf Elamav Zaken Usvayami Vayikru Oso Esav Yaakov Bonav. So here he dies, and he is buried by his sons Esav and Yaakov. So when Avram dies, you may recall, again, this is also a Shishi, so it was more Shishi synergy, but if you recall, when Avram dies, so he's buried by Yitzchak and Yishmael. So Yitzchak is mentioned first there, even though Yishmael was older. And here, Esav is mentioned first. So that's interesting. This is one of the proofs that Yishmael did tshuva. The Gemara says the fact that Yishmael deferred to the tzaddik Yitzchak, even though he was older, so that's a reference that he did tshuva. And apparently Esav did not do tshuva. Rav Hirsch comments over here that this was also meant to highlight that, as we discussed also in the Shishi of 2 weeks ago, that Yaakov may have got the Bechorah, but he didn't get anything from it. He didn't gain from it. He didn't take a higher status. And you see that he defers, he's deferential to Esav, even though he brought the birthright. This is an idea that you find in the beginning of the parasha also, because when it says that, when the pasuk says that Yaakov sends a message, La Adoni LeEsav, to my master Esav, so the Ramban has a comment there that he doesn't really have to refer to him that way. He brought the Bechorah, but because he was trying to butter him up, so he deferred to him, and he referred to him as his master. It was an interesting lumdish question to ask about the Ramban, but it's very evolved, so I won't mention it now, but you can ask me about it afterwards. But that attitude that Yaakov is deferring to Esav, even if he doesn't have to, there's Naim LaTorah comments here also that maybe it was especially because we know again from Shishi of 2 weeks ago that Esav said the time's going to come when his father is going to die, and then he's going to kill Yaakov. So this was a major shas sakana for Yaakov. But here Yaakov and Esav are burying Yitzchak together. So you have to imagine that Yaakov's pretty nervous. Esav has said he's going to kill him on that day. So perhaps he was going out of his way to be deferential and to let him go first and to try to stay on his good side, because he felt that that was a time of tremendous sakana. Okay, so the next parak begins, the middle of Saliyah. Ve'ela told us Esav hu Edom. So now we get to hear the story of Esav. So Esav lakach es nashav mibnos Kanaan, es ada bas elon achiti, es alivama bas ana bas siman achiti. So he had these Canaanite wives, and he has basmas bas Yishmael achos nevoyos, and also basmas. So here Rashi comments, and he may recall that this is something we spoke about at length at the beginning of the year, so it's a good opportunity for Chazara. So here she's called Basmas, and earlier she's called Machlas, and the reference to Machlas is that really her name was Basmas, as we see here, but Machlas to tell us that there is a Mechilas Avonos, right? So a lot of synergy here is a topic we discussed at length, that when a chassan gets married, so there is this Mechila for all of his history. Did you have a comment?
Are we referring to any specific sin of Esav?
Well, so Esav did a lot of sins, but there is also a lot of discussion in the Mefarshim that it's a big question whether Esav himself did tshuva or tried to do tshuva or got the kapara, because we discussed at length that the kapara that comes for a chasen, do we assume that it's automatic, or do we assume that it is a opportunity, and therefore it's something to capitalize on? So we explain that in the context that this notion of Chazal that Rashi quotes is invoked as one of the explanations for why Chassan and Kala fast on their wedding day. So the idea of fasting seems to suggest that it's not an automatic kapara, but that the kapara comes if you do tshuva, but you take this opportunity, which is a special chance, and you actualize the kapara that way. So that gets into the whole discussion. Where was Esav as far as that's concerned? Did Esav do any kind of tshuva? So some of the Sfarim go through this, and they note that Esav's big problem was that he married these two wives who were going to take him very far away from the path of his father and his grandfather. So perhaps he was marrying a new wife to do tshuva from that. But that's only going to help if he divorces the first wives. So maybe he had that thought and didn't complete it. So he had a machshava tova that he didn't actually follow up on, but it was enough that he should get the kapara, that he should also accomplish whatever it is that's necessary for this mechilas avonos. Rav Moshe Feinstein seems to assume differently. In his Darash Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that the mention is here by Esav in order to emphasize the rishus of Esav. You know, Chazal say that Rishon Gemurim don't do tshuva no matter what. Filu al pisco shel Gehenim. So Rav Moshe suggests that that's also the kind of reference you have here, that there's this opportunity for kapara on one's wedding day, And here, Esav is so bad, he didn't take the opportunity, just to show you just how off he is. And the Imre Emes, who's the Ger Rebbe, has notes that he wrote to the author of the Paris Yosef. So in the Sefer Paris Yosef, it has these notes from the Imre Emes. So he suggests, he's assuming that Esav does get a kapara, and he says that the reference, the context of Esav, is because the Sarah Shal Esav is the one who's makatre on the Jewish people. And when he sees that even Esav himself gets kapara, so then he has a hard time being makatre, and perhaps that's the message. Rav Schwab has a nice little ari here where he notes that the idea, we know that Chazal tell us that Ish V'Isha Zachu Shechina B'nehem, that you have a man and a woman and a couple, when they are meritorious, the Shechina is between them. And he goes on to comment that the idea of sin, sin is selfishness. Sin is pursuing your own desires, and therefore sin is what gets in the way of creating a unit, of creating a couple and having the Shechina there. So therefore, perhaps the idea of a kapara at the time of marriage is because the avera, the sinful nature, is getting in the way of joining as a couple. So perhaps there's kind of a synergy in a different sense, meaning that there's a mutual deal here that, okay, so you want to come together as a couple, so that will bring a kapara for the Averis, which will make it easier to come together as a couple, which will therefore bring the Shechina, and therefore reduce the Averis. It's basically a virtuous circle, so to speak, that each side will nourish the other. I think that's what he's getting at. In this Ha'ara from the Imre Emes, if you want to take a look, it's in the Paras Yosef on Chumash on this Pasuk. So he gives a little bit of a whole overview of this idea of Chasen having Mechila. And he suggests also that's why the Sheva Brachos we say Yotzer Ha'adam, because he reflects the idea that normally when we make Brachos in the morning, we make the Brachos the negative. Shlo Asani Gai, Shlo Asani Isha, Shlo Asani Evet. And the question of why don't we make Brachos in the positive? So some connect this to the Gemara in Erevin, which says Noach Lo Le'adam Shlo Nivra, that we would be better off if we were never created because we're sinful human beings. But if the idea is on the day of the wedding there's a kapara, so we're not sinful anymore, so then we can say finally Yotzer Adam, what we'd like to say every day, we would like to thank God for creating us, not for how he didn't create us, but because of our sinful nature, so we don't feel able to say that. But on the day of the wedding we can say Yotzer Adam, because now that's a day that it's really worth being created. He also has a whole discussion there about if you say now Chasen is domul a melech, so can he be mochel and is covered or not? Is it like a melech? It's an interesting little halachic shtickle he has there in the middle of this whole discussion. Okay, so just to go towards the end here, there's a pasuk that gets a lot of it, surprising attention. That just to continue first reading up to there. So Vateleid. Vateled Ada Laesav es Alifaz, Uvasmas Yalda es Ruel, Valivama Yalda es Yush, Yes Yalom, Yes Korach, Elev Ne Esav es Yubdulo Beretz Kanat. So those are his children, Mikach Esav es Nashi, Yes Bonav, Yes Penosa, Yes Kol Nafshu, Yes Beso, Yes Mimne, Yes Kol Vahemto, Yes Kol Kinyono, Asher Rachash Beretz Kanan, Vayelech El Eretz, Mipne Yaakov Achiv. And he separated from Yaakov. And here also, Soloveitchik had a comment that he separated because he needed space, but he was happy to separate because even if Esav was reformed in any sense of the word at that point, but he still was spiritually so different from Yaakov, it was very difficult for him to be in the same place. It was very difficult for him to feel like he was being monitored by him. So that's the point, that was the real reason, but still he felt that couldn't be with him. Vayeshev Esav Bahar Seir, Esav Hu Edom, Ve'ela told us Esav Edom Bahar Seir, Ela Shmos Ben Esav, Elifaz Ben Ada, Eshes Esav, Ruel Ben Vasmas, Eshes Esav, Vayuv Ben Elifaz, Teman Omar Tzvo, Vigatam Uknaz. So they're listing all the children. And now, here, this next pasuk gets an outsized amount of attention. Maybe we'll end on this pasuk, and the rest of the names we'll read on their own. But this last pasuk gets very unusual attention, partially because it seems like maybe it shouldn't get so much attention. that there's some Sefarim, if I recall correctly, I couldn't find this exact, but I seem to remember, I think, in the writings of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he puts great emphasis on this, and this pasuk is one of the most important psukim in the Torah. And that's significant, especially because it's highlighted by Mamori Chazal and by the Rambam, the Sefer Ikarim, as an example of a pasuk that you would think is unimportant. And that you would say, maybe I would have thought it wasn't written by God. So Avram says, the Rambam writes, that one of the Ikarim is that all the psukim are mepia gvura, whether it's on the one hand, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, or on the other hand, this pasuk, V'simna Haisa Pilegesh Le'alifaz Ben Esav. So this idea, who cares? Timna was a Filagesh. Why is that significant? So that, you shouldn't say it's not significant. You should say that that was also from God, and that's also an important part of the Torah. So there is a whole backstory to Timna. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Sanhedrin, and Daf Tzadi Tes and the Beis, and it actually is very significant. The Gemara tells us that Timna wanted to convert. She wanted to be part of Avram's group, and Avram rejected her. And because she was sent away, so first she said, okay, well, at least I should be a Pilegesh to this family somehow, rather than being a royalty somewhere else, which is what she would have been. And nonetheless, the rest of the pasuk tells us that this did not turn out well. And Vatela Dalifaz es Amalek, Eilav de'ada Eshes Esav. So she gives birth to Amalek, and the Gemara suggests that the anger that Amalek has against the Jewish people is an outgrowth and a reaction to the fact that they were turned away, their mother was turned away by Avram Avinu. And the Torah Tamima has a comment, others talk about this also, that presumably Avram wasn't anti-immigration, so to speak, to use the contemporary issue terminology. He wasn't anti-conversion, as we know. He very much embraced converts, so he must have had a reason why he rejected her. Torah Tavima suggests it's because she came looking for Srara, she came looking for Gedula, and that wasn't appropriate. But nonetheless, you find that there is still a price to be paid, there is still criticism. The Medrash, which has this point, so some of the Sfarim suggest the Sefer of Beis Aaron is a Sefer of Klalim. So in his introduction, he talks about how everything is important and how this pasuk is important and how you might think it's not saying anything. And you see, when you know this backstory, it has this message of just how impressive Avram was to the world, that you see people went to such lengths to try to cleave to him, to try to be a part of his family, even if they got pushed away. And the Ramban over here, a little earlier, and Chaim Volozhiner later says a little bit more, that they suggest that the reference to Timna being a Pilegesh is a way to explain that on the one hand, in reference to Edom, we're told, Lo sasayev Edomi, ki achichohu, that we shouldn't hate Edom because he is related to us, because he's our brother, even if there are issues, we shouldn't hate him. And yet Amalek is a descendant of Edom, and Amalek we are supposed to wipe out and to hate. So Chaim Volozhiner suggests, that the Ramban alludes to also, that the idea of the Pilegesh reference here is to say that, like we alluded to before, with the whole Havmin of Ruvain and Bila, that the children of the Pilegesh are not Mesiaches to the father. So therefore, maybe yes, Edom you're not supposed to hate, but Amalek doesn't have that kind of Yichus, because Amalek is the child of the Pilegesh. But in any event, it's very striking that here we have to assume that Avram Avinu knew what he was doing, and yet, nonetheless, look at the price that we pay. Look at, we fight Amalek l'dori doris up until Bias Mashiach because of the sense of rejection. And the Rashi of Kambi Avner Golbucht has a essay where he discusses the notion, which comes up in this week's Parsha as well, one of the primary ideas Bali Musar talk about, that earlier in the parasha we find that Dina gets attacked, and Chazal suggests that it's kind of an onesh because she was hidden from Esav. Yaakov had put her in a box and hid her from Esav, and therefore deprived Esav of an opportunity to do tshuva. Maybe Esav would have married her and would have turned over a new leaf. So because of that missed opportunity, so these were the consequences. And the question could always be asked, I mean, what? Was Yaakov crazy? I mean, why would Yaakov want to marry off his daughter to Esav? And would you say to somebody who's looking for a shidduch for his daughter, should say, oh, you should find the worst possible shidduch you can find, because if you have a good daughter, so she'll be able to have an impact on this guy, so find the worst guy, and you'll have the greatest possible impact. Would any father be looking for such a shidduch for his daughter? You say, oh, the better she is, the more you should look for the worst shidduch. So no one would say that. So clearly Yaakov was acting the only way a responsible father would act, by saving his daughter from Esau. So the Bali Musar explained that, yes, he made the right decision, but he still has to feel the loss. He didn't feel bad enough about it. He said, okay, this is what I got to do. So too bad, Esau, throw you under the bus. We don't worry about what happens to you. And that's not the attitude. The attitude has to be that, Nebuch, I have to prioritize the well-being of my daughter, but at the same time, to have Rachmanis for the lost opportunity in terms of Esav. And so to hear, yes, Avram presumably made the right decision in saying that Timnah was not a good fit for the Jewish people, but push her away with two hands instead of one, so to speak, as some of the Sfarim say, and not have an appreciation for what was lost. So that has consequences, and we see that Amalek comes out of this situation. So it's a powerful reminder. So often we kind of only focus on one direction, and we say, okay, if we have to sacrifice A for B, so that's the decision, and I never think about A again. And the Bali Musar here remind us that that's not the way we're meant to be, that at the same time as we can't let our Rahmanis for A lead us to not do what we need to do, but that Rahmanis still has to be there. We still have to balance these two emotions, and that's a part of the ongoing challenge that a number of points in this parsha reminds us of. Okay, so we will stop here. Again, Sunday, I guess we'll try.